This morning we hear an insider's account of the origins of today's protest movements and what they can achieve now. As Americans take to the streets to resist the presidency of Donald Trump, L.A. Kaufman's history of protest offers unique insights into how past movements have won victories in times of crisis and backlash, and how they can be most effective today. Kaufman, a longtime grassroots organizer, examines how movements from ACT UP to Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter have used disruptive tactics to catalyze change despite long odds. Her new book is Direct Action: Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. I spoke with Kaufman about why she wanted to put together such a history.
I've been an organizer and an activist for 35 years now. I've been in and around grassroots movements, sometimes as a journalist, sometimes as a participant, sometimes deeply involved. And this book is an attempt to write a history of what happened to the American left after the 60s, a story that has very rarely been told.
So you would have written this book regardless of what happened on November 8th.
Yeah, well, I actually worked on this book for a ridiculously long time. This book has been in the making for 25 years.
Okay.
And it just happens that I finished it. I read the very final page proofs on the day after the election. So when I wrote it, I was expecting a different outcome. But when I sat down and read it the day after the election, it's very much a story of how grassroots movements over time have dealt with crisis, with backlash, and with reaction, and managed to win victories despite the inhospitable larger political climate.
It does put it into a new context, which is, of course, the question that has been asked by many, and you address it in this book, of what happened to the protest movement after the 1960s, and why are there not more people in the streets? Now, we obviously, since the election, are seeing more of that, and I'm interested in, are we seeing parallels to what caused those protests 40, 50, 60 years ago?
Well, I think there's always a lot of different motivations for why people decide to go out into the streets and protest something that's happening. The movement that we've seen emerge since the inauguration, kicking off with the massive women's marches on January 21st, has really built on these long, slow shifts that I chart in the book, where we no longer have a single thing called the left. Instead, what we have is more of a model of networked resistance, a movement of many movements. And that's what we're seeing being mobilized in many different contexts now in the resistance to Trump, which has so far been, I think, broader and larger in scale than anyone was expecting it would be.
So I know you were there, so let me just ask this question and how, in your experience, is this a normal reaction? So the original travel ban is announced, it's signed, and within hours, people like yourself showed up at airports all across the country. You went to JFK, and you protested. Mm-hmm. And that was really without any urging. It just seemed like a natural reaction that people had of that's where they went to show their outrage. I'm curious as to what you make of that, of even the role that social media, that many people will say of the role that social media has played in actions like that, and why it is such a visceral reaction of something like that happening and occurring, and people want to take an immediate action.
Right. Well, the first version of the Muslim ban was implemented in such a poorly planned way that, of course, there were people in the air, who were being stopped when they reached the airports, which is different from the way this second one is rolling out. It didn't really come out of nowhere. I mean, the way I knew to go to JFK was that there are longstanding immigrant rights organizers who started activating their text messaging loops. And then from there, it spread on social media and many other people heard about it. There's a way in which when these mobilizations happen, people think of them as coming out of nowhere because they're so fast. But there's actually organizers behind it. The same has been true of the many other protests that have happened. Certainly with the Women's March, there was a lot of solid organizing behind it. But that feeling that people are having of wanting to put their bodies in the way of the harmful policies that this administration is trying to roll out. It's just a very powerful, visceral expression of outrage. And it was very moving that day at the airport. I think that kind of mobilization, that fast mobilization, shows the deep emotions that people are feeling and the deep sense of really wanting to do what they can to stop these damaging policies from rolling out.
So let's talk about the protests that you talk about in the book and this whole idea of direct action and how it works. How does it ultimately make a difference?
Right. Well, direct action describes a whole range of different tactics that people can use to bring pressure to bear from the outside on decision makers, whoever they may be. Usually that's somebody in government, but sometimes it can be someone in business or in some other context. And the way direct action works is it shines a spotlight on injustices that have been hidden from public view, right? So, for example, those airport protests, having all those people at the airport really dramatized the terrible situation for the people who were detained when they were flying in. That might have been invisible and the scale of it not seen if those protesters had not been there. And what it also does is, when it works well, is it creates a sense of crisis. It creates a crisis for the decision maker, forcing them to take action, putting them in a dilemma where you've created a problem that they have to address it and make it go away, or they're going to have a continuing crisis on their hands. That's the big strategy right now behind the resistance movement to Trump, is to keep this administration off balance, in a state of crisis, to limit the harm that it can do.
Well, we certainly have seen the crisis, but would that chaos be there regardless, meaning that it's a self-imposed chaos?
Well, certainly. I'm one who always says that you should never underestimate the role of human incompetence in history. and there's been a level of ineptitude in the Trump administration, which I, for one, welcome and celebrate, because the more inept they are, the less damage they can do. The Guardian ran a nice roundup of concrete ways you can already see the impact of the resistance movement, whether it has been the cancellation of some plans. There was a plan to privatize a huge amount of public lands that was dropped, or whether it's scaling back in the way that they've been forced to do with some of the other executive orders. Steve Bannon, I think, was looking for a much more aggressive rollout than they've been able to do. So some of what we've accomplished can't be seen because it's in what didn't happen that might have happened otherwise. Yes, absolutely, their ineptitude plays a part, but I think the resistance movements, the many different protests since the inauguration, the pressure at the town halls on members of Congress, all of that is contributing to, again, what I think of as the very welcome disarray with this administration.
You said something a moment ago, and I understand what you're saying, is that the more inept they are, you celebrate that because the less damage they can do. But you do look at this and think to yourself, okay, they're inept, and man, they can do a lot of damage.
Yes. I mean, I'm being a little flippant because, of course, the stakes are staggering. I mean, there's the concern about nuclear war, among other things. I mean, there's the concern
right.
of what kind of damage can be done to the climate at a time when we are experiencing already the effects of human-caused climate change. I mean, the stakes are very serious. So, when I joke about their ineptitude, that's worrisome as well. I mean, it's very worrisome, to be sure, in the arena of foreign policy, where they seem to be, playing games with loaded guns and they don't even know what the risks are.
Let me ask you a question about what one of the things that is fascinating, and you do address it in the book, but I just want to talk about this as a logistical question, which is, you know, sometimes if you're protesting, say, the war in Vietnam or in 2003, the buildup to the war in Iraq, and there is a focus. But here there seems to be so much. I mean, you yourself have protested in the Women's March. You were protesting regarding the travel ban. You were part of the Stop Bannon movement. There does seem to be a point where you have to decide, right? I mean, that it's all inclusive. I understand that, and yet there is a triage here of what takes precedent and what you are going to show that resistance to.
Well, the advice that I've been giving to people who are looking to get involved now is to pick one thing that you're going to commit to. That could be an issue that you're really passionate about, a group you feel really connected to, or even a regular action that you'll take. There's a lot of apps and things that have now been set up for people to maybe commit to call their members of Congress once a week. Whatever level of commitment you're able to make, find one place in this, you know, sprawling landscape of resistance to commit to, and then on top of that, mobilize when you can in these moments of crisis. We're going to be on the defensive, and the grassroots movements are going to be reacting, and there's going to be moments like the day of the original Muslim ban when it's important for people to drop everything and show up and mobilize. So that's what I'm encouraging people to do. It's overwhelming if you try to go to everything. Nobody can and nobody should, because this is a long-term process of political engagement.
So as a person who has spent a lifetime in this engagement and of protesting and resistance, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, I have not. And I've been feeling that in my bones since the day of the Women's March, when with a couple of other long-term organizers, we pushed our way through the crowd, got to the center of the mall. You know, we had been to a number of the largest demonstrations in U.S. history before that, and that sense that, wow, this is more people in one place than I have ever seen. The movement that is unfolding now, it's multi-generational, right? There's not the splits between the older generation and the younger generation that we saw in the 60s. It's multiracial, it's multi-issue, it's engaging a lot of people in direct action and protest who were more, you know, moderates and progressives and liberals, who weren't on the far left side of the political spectrum, but are looking to the tactics and tools and methods that movements of the left have developed now to exert pressure in a lot of different ways. So I'm very alarmed by the moves of this administration, but I'm incredibly heartened by the scale and character of this resistance movement, which is absolutely unlike anything I've experienced in 35 years of organizing.
During the Women's March and right after, there were some very dismissive words that came from the administration and from the president about how, well, where were these people when they went out and voted, and diminishing the numbers and so forth. And I understand that that's a tactic to push aside and to marginalize what was done and what was accomplished by those protests and by the marches, not only in Washington, but across the country and across the globe. With that said, there's a kernel there of where was that outrage prior to the election? And I am curious as to your thoughts of how this resistance, this direct action, this protest does eventually get people more involved in the political process to correct things before they happen.
You know, I think we're seeing that already, and I think that's part of what I was talking about by saying that I'm seeing many more liberals and progressives activated. I see, you know, there are so many people who are now planning to run for office. There are so many people who are showing up for their town hall meetings, who are thinking about 2018, who are thinking ahead to 2020. I think there's an activist energy being invested in the electoral arena that we haven't seen. You know, we could go into a lot of postmortems about why we didn't see it in the same way during the campaign of Hillary Clinton. But I don't. There have been some moments when grassroots movements have kind of ignored the electoral realm and ceded that to other folks, and I don't see that happening now. I think people understand that, you know, right now there's a certain amount we can accomplish through resistance and opposition, but ultimately it's not just about being ungovernable, a word that people are using a lot, but thinking about how can we govern differently over time.
The name of the book is Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. The book is published by Verso. L.A. Kaufman, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe. It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.